KBOO Community Radio is now on Venmo. Follow us and send a donation anytime at KBOO Radio. That's at KBOO Radio. Thanks.
At KBOO, we accept many kinds of vehicle donations. We accept fuzzy vans, broken cars, zippy scooters, seaworthy boats, well-worn farm equipment, family-sized SUVs, old jet skis, and more. If your vehicle has a clean title, we can take it as a donation. If your vehicle isn't working, we can work with that too. Call 877-KBOO-123. That's 877-526-6123. Or go to our website, kboo.fm/vehicle.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it.
Hello, KBOO listeners. In order to improve our service to you, and thanks to your support, we are conducting planned maintenance to our FM transmitter tonight between 7 to 9 p.m. This will require us to turn off the FM broadcast during that time. You will still be able to listen to regular programming via the web stream at kboo.fm or via the KBOO app. Thanks for your understanding as we improve this service.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, California, you are listening to Flashpoints, and I'm contributing producer Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, we track the progress of the Select Subcommittee as they keep researching the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Sam Husseini, independent journalist, joins us to analyze their findings. Then, tracking hate. First, I talked to a recently unionized bookstore employee about how they're staying resilient despite being targeted with hate flyers and hate recruiting materials in their books. Then I talked with the Southern Poverty Law Center about the rise in hate against the LGBTQ+ community and what we can do about it. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints. I am Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Joining us now is independent journalist Sam Husseini. Welcome back to Flashpoints, Sam.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Sarah.
You're here to talk to us today about July 11th's Select Subcommittee on the Coronavirus Pandemic. The committee has been meeting for a while. Tell us why, and then tell us about the hearing on July 11th. In context for anyone who has not been following the hearings.
Sure. Well, this subcommittee has been meeting on and off for a couple of years as to why that could get complicated, because it's ostensibly, among other things, to find out the origins of the pandemic. I'm not convinced that either the Republicans or the Democrats want to actually get there. This hearing was particularly interesting because the two people, there were two pillars of propaganda that tried to and succeeded in convincing the global public that COVID could not have lab origin. One of them was in February of 2020, known as the Lancet letter. It was drafted by Peter Daszak of EcoHealth Alliance and signed by 27 other scientists. And it dismissed the possibility of lab origins as a quote-unquote conspiracy theory. Peter Daszak's EcoHealth Alliance actually funded the Wuhan Institute of Virology, the labs there. He ended up being on the WHO committee to determine the origins of the pandemic. And then for a time, he was named by Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University to head the committee of to determine the origins of the pandemic. Throughout all this, he claimed that he had no conflicts of interest. It was brazenly laughable, but it largely dominated discourse on the subject until about the middle of 2021, when Jeffrey Sachs finally proclaimed that Peter Daszak wasn't being straight with him and asked him to resign. The other major pillar of propaganda was this paper called Proximal Origins, which was the focus of this recent hearing. There were several authors of it. Only two were there. And if you want to, we can get into what happened to the other ones. But the two who were there were a great deal of interest generally, and to me in particular. They were Robert Gary of Tulane University and Christian Anderson of Scripps Research. Their paper was more of a disguised as a scientific document than the Lancet letter, and it purported to show that COVID could not be a laboratory construct. But if you really delved into it, didn't show that. It basically made arguments like, well, there's this weird fern cleavage site, and that's strange, but it's not done in an optimal way, so therefore it's not engineered. It's kind of like saying if somebody died, it can't be a murder because the murderer would have been smarter into how he murdered the victim. It was a specious argument, and I actually wrote a piece that appeared in Salon in April of 2020, noting that this piece that everybody, virtually every media outlet on the planet was citing to dismiss the possibility of lab origins, from the New York Times to CNN to virtually every major media outlet to Democracy Now. So they finally brought these people forward. Now, the Republicans focused on one particular aspect of the Nature Medicine article, and that is that there have been a lot of FOIAs going on, people, different groups attempting to use the Freedom of Information Act to get information. Most have been denied or stalled, and this is a huge problem. Some have come out, however, and some of the information that has come out included emails between Fauci and his fellow Jeremy Farrar, who is head of the Wellcome Trust and is now chief scientist of the WHO, with the people who would sign this Nature Medicine article. And basically what the emails show is that these scientists, Gary and Anderson, initially were highly skeptical about natural origin. They were saying, hold on, this might have come out of a lab. And emails indicate that they shifted their position in a matter of about 3 days. And then they got huge grants from the NIH. And the Republican focus was on trying to pin things either on China or on Fauci. That was their focus during the hearings. And the focus of most of the Democrats was to pretend that this was not a subject worthy of serious consideration, and to finally tacitly admit that, yeah, maybe we need to look at some lab safety issues, and yeah, maybe these are some relevant issues, but to generally dismiss and undermine the whole structure. You even had, you know, some representatives, some Democrats like Jamie Raskin, taking the opportunity to attack Trump for not being tough enough on China. You know, there was just, you know, ridiculous political posturing throughout the whole affair. These two, Anderson and Gary, are of particular interest to me because part of what I did early on in the pandemic was I started looking at the scientists who it was clear to me were lying about the possibility that it could have lab origin. It turns out that Gary and Anderson run the Viral Hemorrhagic Fever Consortium. Gary's the president, Anderson is the vice president. These are labs in West Africa, and many Africans in 2014 blamed them for the Ebola outbreak. People might recall there was a Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014. Over 11,000 people died. It was probably the largest global crisis of that year. These Africans who charged this in 2014 were dismissed as crazy, deluded, conspiracy-minded, ignorant people. I dug into this and I wrote a 12,000-word paper with Jonathan Latham, a virologist with the Bioscience Resource Project, and we concluded that there was a very strong case for it, that it did indeed have lab origin, that the dominant narrative simply doesn't hold up. This Ebola outbreak took place over 1,000 miles away from past Ebola outbreaks. It's very similar in a lot of ways to the COVID outbreak. In past Ebola outbreaks, there was a die-off of local mammalian species. That didn't happen in this case. They pinned it on a toddler playing with bats in a town just over the border from Sierra Leone, where the U.S. lab was, into Guinea. It seemed designed to, you know, make people not associate the outbreak with the country where the U.S. labs were. They claimed that this toddler was the first index case playing with bats. The people in the village don't think that he died of Ebola. The healthcare workers, his father, think that he died of malaria. We go through it, and lots of interesting other aspects to that investigation. For example, people might be aware that the Obama administration put a pause on so-called gain-of-function lab work. That is, lab work that is actually designed to make pathogens more transmissible or more deadly. The U.S. government funds this. This has been the source of objections by lots of people, from Francis Boyle, who wrote the Bioweapons Convention implementing legislation in the United States, to many other people. It is continued largely at Fauci's insistence. Anyway, the Obama administration actually placed a pause in the funding for this work in 2014. The exact date was actually October 17th. Interestingly enough, that's the same date that Ron Klain became Ebola czar. That indicates to me that there's a connection between those two things, that Ron Klain's, maybe not familiar to most people, is a very influential Democratic Party insider. He was actually Biden's chief of staff until just a few months ago. So the actions of the Obama administration indicate that they suspected, at least, that it was lab origin, and that's why they cut off the funding for this dangerous lab work. But there were exceptions, and one of the exceptions was this work that was done in Wuhan, and it was done by a scientist, Ralph Barrick, at University of North Carolina with the Wuhan Institute of Virology. In 2015, they published a paper outlining the work they had done to use gain-of-function on coronaviruses, and that, you know, leads to extreme suspicions that there is a relationship between this dangerous lab work and the outbreak of the COVID pandemic. And my further suspicion is that these two scientists, Anderson and Gary, are potentially implicated in the Ebola outbreak of 2014. And so they had an incredible incentive to cover up the COVID outbreak, because if the global public understood in early 2020 that it could have lab origin, I think that there would have been a mass global move or movement to deal with this dangerous lab work. And one of the next questions would have been, what about past outbreaks? People dismissed it when the Africans were talking about it in 2014, but it seems that there's a strong case that the Africans were, in fact, the canaries in the coal mine. What befell them in 2014 is similar to what befell the world in 2019. So there were several problems with this hearing, as I alluded to. Nobody, not even the Republicans, not even the Republicans who were attacking Anderson and Gary most strongly, explained to the public exactly what was going on. For example, the Democrats and Anderson and Gary would deflect responsibility from Fauci, because the Republicans were focusing on, we got to get Fauci and we got to show how he was pulling all of the strings to this. They deflected this by saying, oh no, it was Jamie Farrar who called that meeting. So you're wrong in placing all this blame on Fauci. Well, I mean, I've written about Jamie Farrar. It doesn't deflect from the cover-up. It actually highlights the cover-up. And nobody told the viewing audience, and I don't even know if the Republicans are aware, I assume they're aware, Jamie Farrar is a highly problematic figure. I indicated that the first pillar of propaganda was the Lancet letter, and Peter Daszak is the most noted signer of that. But Jamie Farrar also signed that. So Jamie Farrar is central to this cover-up of COVID origins. He is directly tied to both pillars of propaganda, both the Lancet letter as well as the Nature Medicine Proximal Origins paper. Even more disturbingly, he was just a few months ago named the chief scientist for the World Health Organization. And I haven't followed it, but the World Health Organization is revamping its treaty, and many people are charging that it effectively is a power grab, sort of similar to what the WTO tried to do some 20, 25 years ago. And at the time, before he became chief scientist of the WHO, Jamie Farrar was head of the Wellcome Trust. The Wellcome Trust is roughly the equivalent of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the United States. It's a very substantial foundation that, you know, gives money and guides science in various ways. And it got its funding, you know, from the merger and then spin-off of several pharmaceutical conglomerates, GlaxoSmithKline and so on. So rather than say, oh, okay, Jamie Farrar called him in, well, let's look at Jamie Farrar, the Republicans didn't do that. Similarly, the name of Ron Fouchier came up as having participated behind the scenes in some of these meetings as if he was some kind of distinguished scientist. Ron Fouchier is an incredibly, at minimum, controversial figure. Ron Fouchier is from the Netherlands, and he conducted possibly the most controversial so-called gain of function, also known as creation of potential pandemic pathogens research in 2011. It actually made some headlines when he did this. He took the avian flu, which is highly, highly lethal, but not easily transmissible, and did a scientific procedure, a series of scientific procedures. He passed it through a series of ferrets. Ferrets' pulmonary system is similar to that of humans. So he made it so that it was more easily transmissible to humans. It's been estimated that well more than 8 billion with a B people would die if what he created got out of a lab. It's a highly deadly disease, a fatality rate of 50%, far more lethal than COVID, but not easily transmissible, and he made it transmissible. The New York Times at the time had a editorial warning about this, an engineered doomsday. But all of this has largely gone down the memory hole. And here we have Ron Fouchier, because he's notorious, he didn't sign any of these documents. He didn't sign the Lancet letter. He didn't sign the Nature Medicine article, but he played a behind-the-scenes role in molding them. That should be part of an indictment of the process. Instead, in these hearings, because the Republicans are only out to get Fauci and to get China, and the Democrats are out to pretend that there is no problem, those fundamental facts as to the deep structure of what's going on here and the incredible danger that this poses to humanity were completely obscure. So, you know, I think unless, you know, there's some forms of grassroots pressure and unless some kind of independent media asserts itself at a greater level, you know, we are going to live with a horrific potential problem for until it manifests itself in a far more dangerous way. There are some, you know, glimmers of hope. I know that there have been local councils and, you know, local towns called for a local jurisdiction cutoff prevention of any gain of function lab work being done. So I think at the local level, there's some progress, but it's kind of amazing to me how there's sort of a symbiotic relationship, a twisted symbiotic relationship between the Democrats and the Republicans on this, even though they seem to be calling each other names. And the end result is that the dangerous lab work continues. That is, because the Republicans are focusing on Fauci and China and the Democrats are deflecting, that in effect is a recipe for continuing things. The other major recent development was Congress unanimously passed a bill calling on the Director of National Intelligence to disclose all information. They claimed, the sponsors of the bill, claimed that it would disclose all information regarding COVID origins. That's not what the bill says. The bill actually says disclose all information pertaining to origins of COVID and the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So that is, if there's information that implicates other entities, it would not necessarily be covered by this legislation. The Director of National Intelligence broke the law. They didn't meet the deadline. They ended up putting it out on a Friday night, some 5 days after the deadline. It happened to be the same time that the so-called coup was happening in Russia, so it even got less attention than something that might get attention on a Friday night. And it was only 10 pages long. It didn't have any, you know, of the, you know, real documents and background and so on, and it was kind of indeterminative. So on a number of counts, the Biden administration seems to have violated even this incredibly limited law that Congress unanimously passed on this subject.
Thank you for that analysis. Labs are shrouded in secrecy. Dangerous lab work, as you call it, mm-hmm. is shrouded in secrecy. And I'm not talking about China or only China, right? But here, it's been pretty documented that they're working on things in laboratories and don't always have full control and are not very transparent. And really, where would we be if we as the public knew that bioweapons were being engineered? Like, what is the purpose of doing this work to make something more highly transmissible? Is it that it's going to help cure it? Is it that it can be used as a bioweapon? Or what are all those reasons? Where can people get more information about not just your analysis, but on the Select Subcommittee, if they want to follow along, and also to read more about the 2014 Ebola outbreak?
My writing, which links to the Subcommittee, which links to a bunch of other resources, is at Substack now, Husseini.substack.com. That's Husseini .substack.com, which is sort of an independent journalist platform. But you're absolutely right in how you frame things, Sarah. The one good thing about a nuclear war is that you know that it happened. You could be in the middle of a bio war and you wouldn't know it. Ask the Cubans, right? They've continuously charged over the decades that the U.S. has used bio warfare against them, and the U.S. government response is prove it. And you can't prove it. It's very difficult to prove that something is a bioweapon rather than a naturally occurring thing. So they're often thought of as a poor man's weapon, but they're not. They have a unique attribute, which is deniability. When you talk to scientists, a lot of them will say there are no civilian practical applications for this kind of lab work. It's effectively biowarfare by another name. This notion of appealing to the benevolence of science and so on, it's not the scientists who are determining things. There's a political economy, there's a funding structure, and it's not necessarily out to help humanity. It's in significant part to be creating weapons.
So we're going to end on that thought, and we'll follow more of this. Moving forward, we've been talking to independent journalist Sam Husseini. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoint, Sam.
Thank you, Sarah.
Bye for now. Joining us now, a member of Copperfields Bookstore in Petaluma, California, and from Copperfields Petaluma Union. I want to welcome you to Flashpoints, Elizabeth.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, sadly and scary, on June 21st, 2023, Copperfields Bookstore found white supremacist business cards placed in books. Tell us about this incident, what was found, and where.
My coworkers that work in our used department in the basement found white supremacist business cards sticking out of books in our World War II, our Holocaust, and our civil rights sections. They were sticking out very obviously, so as people could see them. They were very boldly placed there, and it was a very obvious message to send to whoever sees them. And this is a very diverse bookstore, both like racially and LGBT. And so it sent a very clear message to everybody in the store and even just to customers that might have seen it. And this is the second time that it's happened since late March, which it was addressed by our corporate offices, and we are making moves to deal with it. But this one, the first time it was a little more hidden in the books, and this time was very obviously placed out. And the coworkers of mine who found it, they alerted those that were in the store first, so they made sure to go around and make sure everybody was okay. And then they called our corporate offices to make them aware of the situation and that it was escalating in a sense of growing more bold, in our opinion.
I'm very sorry to hear that. How are you feeling today, especially coming on and telling your story?
You know, a lot of people around the store are a little worried about this, especially in the socio-political climate that we're all dealing with, you know, on a daily basis, and how it's kind of ramping up for people in these areas. But I know that our store specifically has really come together to form this really lovely community. And we've pulled together to support each other during an act of terror upon our store. And it's as scary as it is. And I've had a coworker tell me that he fears for his life coming in. It has been also very welcoming, and I guess not welcoming, but it's been very heartening to see the fact that we are taking the action into our own hands. Like, we've moved the sections that they've placed the white supremacist cards in. We've moved it so it's in a more clear line from our front register so that we can see it at all times. On the day that it happened, our manager made sure to go around to each and every store and like on with our local businesses that are around us, and she made sure to make them aware of what was happening. She didn't show them the hatred that was on the cards, but she made sure that they saw what they were so they could be aware of it. So it's been sad for sure to know that such hatred has made its way to our community, but it's also been, as much as I can say, really lovely to see how we've pulled together to support one another, which is the best thing that we can do. And we've been getting a lot of support from the community for our store and from like our local community online profiles and stuff, making everybody aware of it. So the mood is still a little worried, but we have such a strong community that I feel we'll be able to take care of each other.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. So you mentioned some things that the bookstore and as a corporation is doing. Can you tell us a little bit more about what the bookstore plans to do, what they can do? Have they gotten legal advice?
It's still really early in the situation for us to be able to do much other than moving things around and doing things for us to feel safer in our store. Our corporation is, Copperfields, is definitely keeping their eye on it, and they're making all of our other stores in the chain aware of what's happening. And we have contacted the local authorities just to let them know that this is something that's happening in the community and to keep their eyes out for it. That's really as much as we can do with such a short time. You know, nobody's really prepared for something like this. So it's kind of mostly just seeing what we can do in the moment and trying to support each other as best as we can right now.
What was the reaction of law enforcement?
I believe that they came in today for the first time to talk to us. And so we have an officer assigned to our case. And it's really just been giving them the information that we need. So we've been getting support from a local officer, but I'm not too sure. I haven't been the one handling that. Our assistant managers and our manager are the ones that are mostly been talking to them. So we've been getting support as much as we can in that situation when we have little to go on other than, you know, a very aggressive cards being left in our books.
And so we decided, you know, before this interview that we weren't going to be naming any organizations to give them voice who are putting hate speech flyers or business cards in your books. However, is there anything that you can say to us about how open and upfront are these business cards? Is it like literally call this number, a website? How much detail was there if they're to be used as recruiting tools and not just, you know, fear-mongering tools?
On the backs of the cards, it has very clear statements about how the white race is apparently disappearing, and people that they label to be as other are meant to be put in their place, that it's the time to act. It's very scary, kind of, do you feel disenfranchised almost for white people specifically? And having such a call to action, mostly. That's what the backs of the cards say. And I haven't looked at the front of the cards. I don't really want to know anything about them. I don't want them to hold any place in my mind. But the front of them, I believe, has their information. And we've only shared the back of the cards online on our Instagram post, just so that people can see what is being spread and the clear intent and the hatred for people that they view as quote unquote not one of them.
I am sorry that you are going through that. The Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, they indicate that racist flyering incidents across the nation in 2020 grew to well over 4,000 incidents across the nation. What can you tell us about if other bookstores that the corporate office owns or other local businesses are in the area, if they've also been having flyers or business cards similar to this?
So we have been reached out by the ADL, which is the Anti-Defamation League, and they have given us a little information on like how to handle this. And so I would definitely suggest that if any businesses have been targeted like this, to talk to them about it, because the information that they've given us, which is, you know, don't give them, pay them any mind, calling them out is good, but not sharing their name, has been very helpful and very affirming in choosing not to share them, you know, because it's not clear what to do in this situation. But I can say that this isn't an isolated incident. Other cards have been showing up in the area as like a clear act of terror. And that's from another organization that was shared with us. And it's very clear that they want to make diverse workplaces uncomfortable. And you're right, it has been trending lately. There was an incident in Santa Rosa that happened at another very diverse business, and they had hate speech on the front of their store. And the biggest thing that we can do is come together in solidarity and make sure that the community is aware of this, and to really band together and make it clear that this kind of speech is not tolerated in any space, and that we show support for one another, which has been, again, the best thing that's been happening to come out of this is the solidarity of the community that has happened.
And I know the Press Democrat from Sonoma County in California has reported on things similar. I think that you are absolutely correct in not giving specific hate mongers a voice here. I do have a question about, do you think that any books were sold with it in it? Did any customers come to you and say that they had these in their books?
Thankfully, no. Thankfully, we've been very vigilant in looking for them, because like the first event happened, the first time we were, I guess, targeted by this group was in March. And a customer was just perusing the section and they made us aware of it, to which we did another sweep and we found the cards and we took them out. And ever since then, we've just been kind of going through those areas, making sure that they're clear, both upstairs in our new section and downstairs in our youth section. And thankfully, very thankfully, nobody has gone home or bought a book that had hate speech cards in them, which is, you know, nice to know that we've been, nobody has to see it, and that we're remaining vigilant for our community.
Is there anything that you can share with us that the Anti-Defamation League said, or that you've learned about in terms of how we can, you know, heal, recover, bounce back if we feel targeted or see this kind of hate speech?
We were just asking them about like our social media presence, if we were doing the right thing with sharing it and then sharing their name. And the best thing you can do is when you find anything like this is to not inform your friends, family, community, whoever it might be, of their name, because then people will look them up and they might have websites, and then those websites, you know, those websites get numbers, and then they could have ads on there, and then you're inherently giving them revenue, whether or not it's out of curiosity or anger or, you know, pure pain at what you're seeing, you know. And like I've been saying, you know, the best thing that we can do is band together and talk to one another, really make others aware so that you can get the proper support, and reach out to us, and, you know, reach out to your community, because you're not alone in what you're going through, and absolutely you do not deserve what's happening to you. These are sad, angry people that, you know, just have nothing better to do than to go around to private businesses and spread hatred that holds no home there.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. So the Petaluma staff at Copperfields Bookstore voted to unionize just last month. And then could you just tell us a little bit about why you voted to unionize? What was going on and how is it now?
So for right now, we have officially been recognized as a union, but we're still in the negotiation process. So what that means is they've said, yes, we see that you are a union. We're with the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. And so now that we're officially recognized, we get to go to negotiations with our corporate offices to say, we would like this to happen. And then they can say, you know, basically, it's opening the door for a conversation between us and them for the things that we would like to see improve. And we're in the throes of negotiating right now, and it's going swimmingly. It's actually going really well. So we voted to unionize because we want to, you know, the cost of living in California is constantly going up and wages are not. And we would like better health care for our workers. We would like better pay for the work that we do and the industry knowledge that we carry. And we're advocating specifically, and in this instance is a good example of having proper training for moments like this. You know, on the daily, my coworkers and myself deal with homophobic people, racist people, transphobic people, and a lot of us don't know what to do, you know, when you're faced with either macro or microaggressions. And so we want to get proper training for ourselves to deal with that, and also get proper training for our management so that they can come in and assist us properly. And if you aren't a full-time worker, you only get 24 hours of sick time, which does not refill. And so that's three shifts that you're sick and it's gone. And you know, that's, we would like some more sick time that's going on because we've all gone through COVID and we're all, you know, still getting sick. And so we would like proper sick time. And it's really just kind of calling attention to the things that we just would like to be better.
In your opinion, how has being part of a union been helpful in this situation or for you?
It's been honestly really wonderful because with unionizing our store, not that it's a small enough store. I think we have under or a little over 20 employees, but we've all been talking to each other so much more since this has happened. And we were talking before, but just the immediate response that we could have to this, the text going out saying, are you okay? The conversations that we've been having, the awareness that we've been spreading, it would feel a lot more lonely and for me personally, a little more scary if I didn't have these strong, powerful people with me, these people that, you know, hold themselves up and, you know, it's allowed me to hold myself up. It's allowed our coworkers to share their fear with each other, but to do so in a place where you're safe and you can be lifted up. And, you know, with unionizing, we found a power within ourselves to, you know, immediately, we were action changing the bookshelves. We made active changes that day to combat it. And we are able to hold other people accountable for their actions so that we can feel supported by our corporation that is currently with us, you know? And so we have more of a voice now, and we're able to use that voice as any union does for the better. And we're bettering our situation day by day by building a community within ourselves and having a stronger unified voice.
And so you gave me a short bio earlier. I don't know how much of it you're comfortable saying, but you know, it sounds like you've got a lot going for you. You've been here working here for a while, and you're on a path to additional successes, and you're creative. You just unionized the Copperfields Bookstore in Petaluma, California, and you are part of that Copperfields Petaluma Union. Sorry about the white supremacist leaflets that were put in some of the books at your store. And from what we're hearing, you all and your corporate are doing everything to help everyone who has seen this literature and to prevent others from seeing it. Thank you so much for joining us on Flashpoints. Anything else you want to say?
I would just again like to thank you for having me and for giving us the voice to talk about what is going on in our community and spreading that so other people can be aware. Thank you very much.
And so I want just the absolute best for you and for everyone at Copperfields.
Thank you. I wish the best for you too, and thank you for having me here. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Flashpoints. I'm contributing producer Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. My guest now is R.G. Cravens, Senior Research Analyst at the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And R.G. is here to discuss what they do and what they're monitoring around LGBTQ rights and hate. Welcome to Flashpoints, R.G.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
The Southern Poverty Law Center calls itself a catalyst for racial justice in the South and beyond, working in partnership with communities to dismantle white supremacy, strengthen intersectional movements, and advance the human rights of all people. RG, can you talk to us today about what you specifically do within the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Sure. So as a research analyst, my responsibility is to track and monitor organizations specifically that intersect with the anti-LGBTQ movement. But I also help coordinate our monitoring and understanding of those groups within broader systems of power, like how they relate to and support the, white supremacy, for example.
Tell us about what you see going on these days, and I definitely want to get into broader pictures. Tell us about what you're tracking these days.
Sure. So there's, unfortunately, there's a lot of ways to maybe answer that question. I think that one thing that has been of concern is obviously the kind of current wave of anti-LGBTQ and especially anti-trans activity. Today, I think the line between extremism and mainstream politics is kind of disappearing. Far-right lawmakers are, for example, pushing legislation that sometimes come directly from the scripts of hate groups, including bills that seek to control the bodies of women and those who can give birth, trying to whitewash Black history in schools and criminalize LGBTQ people. And I think, you know, maybe some of your listeners would see this too. Hate and anti-government extremist groups are seemingly descending on Main Street America, disrupting people's daily lives. Schools are a primary target for a lot of this locally driven mobilization. But I think it's fair to say that many of the institutions of American civil society, so the things that are supposed to provide public goods for all of us, make society work for everybody, are being challenged. So places like hospitals and libraries and churches and religious congregations that are inclusive and that value pluralism. We've tracked attacks and violence and intimidation campaigns and protests against them. And much of the time, my work comes in because these places often allow space for LGBTQ people.
That's incredibly unfortunate. Can you talk to us about some of the laws that you're seeing in particular and how they're affecting the community?
So there's what I would say by way of context here is there is a lot of anti-LGBTQ legislation. 2023 had, you know, the highest number by some counts of specifically anti-LGBTQ and anti-trans legislation on record. And I think that legislation, the increase in legislation, is part of a campaign to try to isolate transgender people from the LGBT from the LGB community, right? From lesbian, gays, bisexuals, typically understood as maybe sexual minorities, and their allies, and sort of isolate trans folks, gender non-binary folks, and it's part of what's has been described by some on of the anti-LGBT groups that we follow as a divide and conquer strategy. And that really began somewhat in earnest, I think, with a push to limit civil rights protections in schools in around 2013, 2014. It's a movement that sort of anticipated the marriage equality victory, right? So the Supreme Court, the ruling in Obergefell versus Hodges, which allowed same-sex marriage or marriage equality across the country. It anticipated that, and I think a lot of the movement organizations wanted to sort of turn back that progress and also regain some of their influence that was lost in the run-up to that victory. And right now we're seeing the fruit of that campaign as they began targeting transgender folks and transgender rights in an effort to sort of push back broadly against LGBTQ progress and also against progress in a lot of other areas like bodily autonomy, rights to privacy, and these sorts of inclusive policies, progressive policies, you might say.
I think that while there appears to be a lot of media attention, that sometimes we can't really see the full scope of the pain that people endure. Are you able to tell us what some of those stories are?
So I think I can mention a few things. So we released just last month our 2022 report on the year in hate and extremism. And in that report, so it's the 2022 because that's that we chronicled, right, the sort of activities of the groups and that we followed in the year 2022 and just released the report. You know, we tracked 1,225 active hate and anti-government extremist groups across the United States. Specifically, we talked in that report about in the aftermath of the 2020 election and the January 6, 2021 insurrection attack on the Capitol, right? The shift in tactic was to organize locally and pursue agendas in venues where it's easier to gain power and strip minoritized populations and strip communities of their rights and livelihoods. So that's one aspect of that. I think that we could potentially talk about others, but we just came out of Pride Month. And so I think another one specifically related to the LGBTQ community. In 2022, we tracked hate groups appearing at LGBTQ events. We tracked some specific groups who were part of that January 6th insurrection appearing then later across the country in some 40 different LGBTQ events in 2022. So I think those are just, you know, some examples of the ways that SPLC has tracked and sort of contextualized the attacks on communities. And again, I feel like your listeners are probably, you know, maybe have experienced this, right? Seeing protests at school board meetings and you know, at Pride events or at local libraries, right? And I think people are really experiencing that in a powerful way.
Yeah, I mean, what does that do to someone, right? That you just feel like you can't be yourself or that you're being targeted just for being yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, it's, you know, again, sort of part of a broader strategy, I feel, and I think the research would show to sort of push LGBTQ people out of American public life. And you're right. It does have consequences, right, for the lived experiences of LGBTQ folks, especially I would say LGBTQ folks who live at the intersections of marginalized identities, and so are often overlooked, right, by the public institutions that are supposed to serve us. And so when you're sort of targeted, you know, for being both LGBTQ and a person of color, right? Like those experiences those experiences with oppression can be, right, compounded and it does come with again consequences that are devastating for a lot of people.
And I read that the Southern Poverty Law Center recognizes International Transgender Day of Visibility. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah. So I and a colleague actually wrote a commentary about that. It's a very powerful commentary. We actually talked about a lot of these same things. International Transgender Day of Visibility was intended to recognize the important contributions of transgender people to their communities across the world, and to call the world really to action to end prejudice against trans people. And, you know, when we sort of wrote this commentary and it was important, I think, to say that, that, you know, we see and we honor the experience of transgender and gender nonconforming people, especially in places where visibility isn't possible because of transphobia and oppression. And, you know, at SPLC, we talked about how we are committed to challenging the structures and systems that seek to continue to render trans and gender nonconforming people invisible. And I think reflecting sort of on Pride, right? Pride Month in June. What we saw then and what I've mentioned before really emphasizes the need, right, for visibility and to create affirming spaces and intersectional spaces that that speak to the needs of LGBTQ people and you know, recognizing that that, you know, LGBTQ folks have a role to play in their communities, that they are important members of society, that despite the dehumanization that comes from the anti-LGBTQ movement, that we're talking about a resilient community who has stood against oppression, who organized against oppression from sort of the very beginning of the movement and will continue to do so. And that, you know, having the visibility and being visible is important. It may not be accessible to everybody because of where they are and you know, the dangers involved sometimes, but it's a call to action, right, that LGBTQ folks and their allies should stand up, should help to create those affirming spaces and stand against the kinds of oppression that I've mentioned so far.
Thank you for that. And I, you know, sometimes when we talk about extremist groups, you know, whether it be curiosity or anger, whatever reason or research, we might want to look up, okay, well, who is responsible for this? Who are these groups? And I recently interviewed people from a bookstore in California who had flyers in their books from a hate group. And they were instructed by the Anti-Defamation League to not really over-advertise the names of the groups in particular, but to definitely let the community know. And so I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts on that, of, you know, that overemphasis on individual groups. Is that helpful? And if not, why?
Sure. I definitely appreciate the question. And, you know, I can understand the need for community awareness and sort of letting folks know what's going on in the community. And I can also understand and support the idea that there could be it could be that focusing on an individual might obscure the systemic nature of oppression, and that's what we're talking about, right? In these instances, transphobia and homophobia, racism and sexism, heteronormativity. These are systems of oppression. They're institutions of you know, the artifacts of the way our society has been have been constructed, and you know, would agree that it's important to think about these as systems, as well as recognizing, right, how individuals contribute to that.
In closing, what can people do if they're experiencing any type of this violence, or to learn more about the work that you all do?
You can certainly find SPLC in, you know, with our online presence through social media. There are some recommendations there in terms of, you know, policies to sort of prevent and counter hate and extremism. Obviously, if folks are experiencing these things, they should, you know, try to make sure ensure that they're as safe as possible. And in terms of responding, right, when extremism and hate are, you know, evidenced in their community. There's several different, I think, avenues. You know, we have elected officials and business leaders, community members who have to speak out and use their platforms to condemn hate and violence. So there's sort of that aspect. And then, you know, folks can certainly organize locally. I've mentioned this before, but, you know, building community coalitions to help prevent things like the erosion of civil society, right? And those, I didn't really talk so much about it, but that civil society component is connected to democratic norms, right? Like civil society or institutions are important for upholding democracy. And so folks can organize locally, building community to help prevent that erosion and uplift those spaces and organizations that support inclusive, multicultural, multiracial democracy, because the folks that support that kind of democracy outnumber those who don't. You know, and so we can certainly support and defend those inclusive public spaces and inclusive education, right? Because our civil institutions have to work for everybody, or they'll only serve to help entrench the power of those who currently have access.
Thank you so much. And it really makes me think about, like, okay, I go about my day every day, and maybe I'm not experiencing any of this myself, but can I take 1 hour a week, 1 hour a month, what is it, right? To figure out how my community is doing, especially around the issue of LGBTQ rights and any violence that people might be experiencing.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that. We've been speaking to R.G. Cravens, Senior Research Analyst at the Intelligence Project for the Southern Poverty Law Center. We've been discussing how they monitor hate around LGBTQ, but really how they also monitor LGBTQ rights and help uplift the community as well. Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Sarah.
All right. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoints. Thank you, everyone, for joining us on Flashpoints. I've been your host, Sarah Blanco, sitting in for Dennis Bernstein. Thank you to producer and editor Frank Sterling. And thank you to all of our guests.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KABU.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, KABU listeners. In order to improve our service to you, and thanks to your support,